content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the New York Times and the Washington Post. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we begin with a Q&A story, question and answers format, written by Paige McClanahan. It's titled, Rick Steves on the Return of Travel and Why It Matters. This article appeared in the October 30th, 2021 issue of the New York Times. And let's see what travel master Rick Steves has in store for us. On a recent morning, Rick Steves was wandering around the ancient Tuscan town of Volterra with a new crop of tour guides. His company's trips to Europe are set to resume in February 2022 after a nearly two-year pandemic hiatus, and the guides were midway through a nine-day trip around Italy to learn what makes a Rick Steves tour a Rick Steves tour. One of the stops on their itinerary was Volterra, a medieval hilltop town whose stone walls are 800 years old. Mr. Steves, who has been to Tuscany many times for his popular public broadcasting show and YouTube channel, was relishing being back. We're surrounded by the wonders of what we love so much, and it just makes our endorphins do little flip-flops, he said during a phone interview. That unabashed enthusiasm has fueled Mr. Steves' empire of guidebooks, radio shows, and TV programs, as well as tours that have taken hundreds of thousands of Americans overseas since he started running them in 1980. Along the way, Mr. Steves has built a reputation for convincing hesitant Americans to make their first trip abroad, and that first trip is often to Europe, which Mr. Steves has called the waiting pool for world exploration. But he also speaks passionately about the value of travel to places like El Salvador and Iran, and he's open about how his time in other countries has shaped his views on issues like world hunger and the legalization of marijuana. But Europe remains Mr. Steves' bread and butter, and he's back on the continent now, both to prepare for the return of his tours and to work on a six-hour series on European art and architecture that he hopes will be broadcast on U.S. public television next fall. As he wandered through Volterra, we talked about why he doesn't count the number of countries he's visited, why his tour company will require vaccinations, and why a world without travel would be a more dangerous place. Next, we have our Q&A. The conversation has been lightly edited for clarity and length, according to the writer. First question, what does it feel like to be back in Europe? Answer, I'm working with 20 local guides here, and people are almost tearfully emotional about the rekindling of tourism. Professional tour guides have been on hold for two seasons, and they're just so filled with joy to be able to do what they do because guides are wired to enthuse and inspire and teach about their culture and their art and their history. And it's just so fun to be here and be filled with hope. And while we're still in the pandemic, we're also coming out of it, and there's an energy in the streets and in the museums. Question, do you think Americans are ready to travel overseas again? Answer, I would say it's not for everybody, but if you don't mind being well organized and if you're enthusiastic about following the regulations and rules, it's not a big deal. And Europe is ahead of the United States, I believe, in fighting COVID. There's a huge respect for masks. More museums are requiring reservations to get in because they want to make sure it's not crowded. It's a kind of blessing, actually. I was just in the Vatican Museum and really enjoying the Sistine Chapel because it wasn't so darned crowded. That was an amazing experience for me because the last time I was there, I had to wear shoulder pads. Question, you have long held that travel can do a lot of good in the world, but what about carbon emissions, overcrowding, and other negative effects of travel? Answer, climate change is a serious problem and tourism contributes a lot to it, but I don't want to be flight shamed out of my travels because I think travel is a powerful force for peace and stability on this planet. So my company has a self-imposed carbon tax of $30 per person we take to Europe. In 2019, we gave $1 million to a portfolio of organizations that are fighting climate change. We gave half that amount in 2020, even though we stopped bringing people to Europe after the pandemic hit. It's nothing heroic, it's just the ethical thing to do. And in terms of other problems, when you go to Europe, you can consume in a way that doesn't dislocate pensioners and ruin the neighborhoods. Landlords anywhere in the world can make more money renting a short-term tourist than long-term local people. So, if you complain that a city is too touristy and you're staying in an Airbnb, well, you're part of the problem. But we would be at a great loss if we stopped traveling, and the world would become a more dangerous place. We need to travel in a leave-only-footprints, take-only-photos kind of way. What you want to do is bring home the most beautiful souvenir, and that's a broader perspective and a better understanding of our place on the planet, and then employ that broader perspective as a citizen of a powerful nation like the United States that has a huge impact beyond our borders. Question: how do you try to encourage people to travel in a meaningful way? The responsibility of the travel writer is to help people travel smarter, with more experience, and more economically and more efficiently. And everybody has their own idea of what that is, but for me, it's about remembering that travel is all about people. It's about getting out of your comfort zone and trying something new. So we're trying to help Americans travel in a way that's more experiential and more thought-provoking and more transformational. You know, you can have transformational travel, or you can just have a shopping trip and a bucket list. Question: you've said that you don't keep track of how many countries you've visited. Why is that? Why would you? Is it a contest? Anybody who brags about how many countries they've been to, that's no basis for the value of the travel they've done. You could have been to 100 countries and learned nothing, or you can go to Mexico and be a citizen of the planet. I find there's no correlation between people who count their countries and people who open their heart and their soul to the cultures they're in. Question: I hear you're working on a big new project. What's that about? Something I've been preparing to do for 20 years is to collect all the most beautiful art experiences we've included in our TV show and weave it together into a 6-hour series of European art and architecture. We've been working on the show for the last year, and it's going to be my opus magnum, my big project. It's going to make art accessible and meaningful to people in a way that I don't think we've seen on TV before. I'm inspired by people who have done art series in the past, and I've got a way to look at it through the lens of a traveler. I'm very excited about it. It's just a cool, creative challenge. Question: what have things been like for your tour company since the pandemic hit? Well, 2019 is the answer, was our best year effort. We took 30,000 Americans on about 1,200 different tours, and we were just euphoric. We had 2020 essentially sold out when COVID hit, and then we had to cancel everything, so had to send back 24,000 deposits. We all hunkered down, and I've done what I can to keep my staff intact. A couple of months ago, we decided we're confident about the spring of 2022, so we opened the floodgates, and immediately those 24,000 people that had to cancel 2 years ago, well, basically, they're re-signed up. Now we've got 29,000 people signed up out of 30,000 seats for next year. So we're doing really good, but we just have to continue the diligence in our society and in Europe of fighting COVID responsibly. So I'm kind of losing patience with anti-vaxxers. Maybe they're exercising their liberty, but they're also impacting a lot of other people. So we've just decided to require that people have vaccinations to go on our tours. Here in Europe, unvaccinated people would be standing outside most of the time anyway, because they couldn't get into restaurants, onto the train, onto the bus, or into museums. The world is getting progressively smaller for people who want to travel but not get a vaccination. Question: do you think travel will ever feel normal again? There were certain people who decided they didn't want to travel after 9/11 because they didn't want to deal with security. You know, those people have a pretty low bar for folding up their shop. I got used to the security after 9/11, and I'm getting used to COVID standards now. But I do think that come next year, we'll be back to traveling again, and I hope that we'll all be better for it. And Paige McClanahan, our writer, is the host of the Better Travel Podcast, so you might want to Google that and check that out. And by the way, we want to add that changes in domestic and international travel are occurring almost daily because of how various government entities are choosing to respond to the COVID-19 pandemic. The headlines pretty much speak whatever you need to know on a daily basis. And you would be wise to seek the latest travel advisories when planning your next trip, whether it be domestic or international. Well, as we have learned, there are many reasons people travel. One draw has earned the moniker dark tourism. Have you heard that one before? Well, writer Hannah Sampson is going to explore why visitors flock to the sites of tragedy, which pretty much defines what we mean by dark tourism. Her article appeared in the November 13, 2021 issue of the Washington Post. Every year, millions of tourists around the world venture to some of the unhappiest places on earth, sites of atrocities, accidents, natural disasters, or infamous death. From Auschwitz to Chernobyl, Gettysburg, the site of the Kennedy assassination, and the 9/11 memorial in New York, visitors are making the worst parts of history a piece of their vacation, if not the entire point. Experts call the phenomenon dark tourism, and they say it has a long tradition. Dark tourism refers to visiting places where some of the darkest events of human history have unfolded. That can include genocide, assassination, incarceration, ethnic cleansing, war, or disaster, either natural or accidental. Some might associate the idea with ghost stories and scares, but those who study the practice say it's unrelated to fear or supernatural elements. It's not a new phenomenon, says J. John Lennon, a professor of tourism at Glasgow Caledonian University in Scotland, who coined the term with a colleague in 1996. There's evidence that dark tourism goes back to the Battle of Waterloo, where people watch from their carriages the battle taking place, he says. That was in 1815, but he cites an even longer ago example, crowds gathering to watch public hangings in London in the 16th century. Those are relatively modern compared with the bloody spectacles that unfolded in the Colosseum in Rome. There aren't official statistics on how many people participate in dark tourism every year, or whether that number is on the rise. An online travel guide run by enthusiastdarktourism.com includes almost 900 places in 112 countries. But there's no question the phenomenon is becoming more visible, in part thanks to the Netflix series Dark Tourist that was released last year. And popular culture is fueling more visitation to some well-known sites after the HBO miniseries Chernobyl about the 1986 power plant explosion came out this spring. Travel companies that bring people to the area said they saw a visitor increase of 30 to 40%. Ukraine's government has since declared its intention to make the Chernobyl exclusion zone an official tourist spot despite lingering radiation. Philip Stone, executive director of the Institute for Dark Tourism Research at the University of Central Lancashire in England, says anecdotally that he sees the appetite for such destinations growing. I think for political reasons or cultural reasons, we are turning to the visitor economy to remember aspects of death and dying disaster, he says. There's a kind of memorial mania going on. You could call that growth in dark tourism. Why are tourists so enamored with places that are, as Lennon puts it, synonymous with the darkest periods in human history? Academics who study the practice say it's human nature. We've just got this cultural fascination with the darker side of history. Most history is dark, Stone says. I think when we go to these places, we see not strangers, but often we see ourselves and perhaps what we might do in those circumstances. There is no one type of traveler who engages in dark tourism. It could be a history buff who takes the family on a road trip to Civil War battlefields, a backpacker who treks to the Colosseum in Rome, or a tourist who seeks out the near-abandoned areas near the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant disaster in 2011 in Japan. Those who are most familiar with the phenomenon do not condemn it. In fact, they argue that the most meaningful dark tourism sites can help visitors understand the present and be more thoughtful about the future. These are important sites that tell us a lot about what it is to be human, says Lennon, the tourism professor. I think they're important places for us to reflect on and try to better understand the evil that we're capable of. There are even efforts underway to research the way children experience dark tourism. A joint project between the Institute for Dark Tourism Research and the University of Pittsburgh. Mary Margaret Kerr, a professor of education and psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh, says the idea came about when the National Park Service asked her to help create a team to design children's materials for families who visit the memorial to United Airlines Flight 93, which was hijacked on September 11, 2001, and crashed in a field in Pennsylvania. Her research team now includes middle school students who have studied how their peers interact with the National 9/11 Pentagon Memorial in Washington or the site of the Johnstown flood in Pennsylvania, which killed more than 2,200 people in 1889. We wouldn't want families to stop traveling, and adults want to see these places for very good reasons, Kerr says. It's not so much making the decision for parents whether you take the children or not, but what are the appropriate safeguards? She said the goal is to provide appropriate safeguards and ways to experience a site, even for children too young to grasp the history, so the family can be there together, but each member of the family can take meaning that works out for them at their age and stage. As more sites with dark histories become popular spots, even part of the organized tour packages, experts say there is a risk that they could become exploited, used to sell chakkas or placed as backdrops for unseemly photos. It does kind of invite that passive behavior. Let's call that touristy behavior that might be out of place, Stone says. Bad conduct by tourists at sensitive sites, smiling selfies at concentration camps, for example, has been widely shunned on social media. The online darktourism.com travel guide cautions against such behavior, as well as the ethnically questionable voyeurism of visiting an ongoing or very recent tragedy to gape. What is endorsed here is respectful and enlightened touristic engagement with contemporary history and its dark sights and sides in a sober, educational, and non-sensationalist manner, the site says. Lennon says he's sometimes dumbfounded by some of the behavior that gets publicized, but he declines to say what the right or wrong way is for tourists to behave. Overall, he says he still hopes that by visiting places with dark history, people are becoming better informed about atrocities like racial and ethnic cleansing. I'm heartened by the fact that they choose to try to understand this difficult past, Lennon says. And by the way, Sampson, is a staff writer at the Washington Post and has a column called By the Way, which reports on travel news. Next, we're going to undertake a dark tourism quest made by writer Natalie B. Compton. She and a friend spent a night where a horror movie was filmed under the glow of a full moon. Her article, Are the Blair Witch Woods Really Haunted? And she says, I went camping to find out. And her article appeared in the October 28, 2021 issue of the Washington Post. Let's see what she learned. I watched The Blair Witch Project like any other film buff from a laptop on a weekday morning in my living room with all the lights on. This should give you a sense of how I handle scary movies. Why was I doing this? Not for fun. I had pitched my editor on writing a haunted camping story as a follow-up to my story last year in a haunt, or my stay rather, last year in a haunted house. She suggested investigating the woods where Blair Witch was filmed, about 60 miles from D.C. in rural Maryland. Having never seen the 1999 horror classic, I had to watch before I went. Turns out you can't camp in the spot where the main characters stayed, and spoiler, were killed by the Blair Witch, but you can camp in Gathlin State Park, which is just behind the town that was featured in the movie, Burkittsville, Maryland. I wanted to know whether those woods were truly scary off-screen. The movie made me sick with fear, even though I don't believe in ghosts or witches, but I'm willing to be proved wrong. Would reliving the plot be a nightmare? And so the plan was to go to Burkittsville and follow in the film's footsteps. I would talk to locals about how they felt about the reputation Blair Witch gave the town, and if there was any reason to fear the woods. Then at night, under the light of the hunter's moon, I would camp and wait for paranormal activity. And now we get into kind of a journal, and it's dated Wednesday, October 20th, 10:47 a.m. I finished watching The Blair Witch Project minutes before Washington Post videographer Monica Rodman arrived to pick me up. They have experiences covering paranormal activity for work, like the time they interviewed a ghost hunter. Plus, I didn't want to go alone. Another bonus, Monica has a dog named Pony they could bring to protect us. As we started the drive to Burkittsville, a line from the movie kept replaying in my mind. The woods around Halloween is already a creepy phenomenon, one of the main characters Heather said to her fellow doomed campers. Heather wasn't wrong. I'd been camping alone three times before, and I knew that spending the night in the dark outdoors freaked me out, even if I don't think the campsite was haunted. 12:32 p.m., we were driving through the rolling green hills and cornfields when we spotted it, the welcome sign for the historic village of Burkittsville, established in 1824. Unlike the movie claims, it was not once called Blair. Thanks to the popularity of the Blair Rich Project, visitors kept stealing the sign until the mayor decided to lessen its allure by redesigning it. Like every other tourist, we jumped out of the car and took our photo. Then we got back in the car and drove into town. 1:05 p.m. Burkittsville, population roughly 150. It has a post office, a general store, and no restaurants. The place is incredibly charming, even with its Civil War-era cemetery, taking up a good chunk of the town's 294 acres, about a half a square mile. In 1864, Burkittsville became home to a makeshift hospital for soldiers wounded in a battle nearby. In 1999, it became known for the Blair Witch Project. There was about a three-week period where we got a lot of calls asking, did we find the missing people yet? Have we solved the murder? Said Lieutenant Colonel Scott Hopkins, a representative of the Frederick County Sheriff's Office, which presides over Burkittsville. Hopkins came to town to talk to us about the Blair Witch legacy. The film had been advertised as a true story. Some of the marketing stunts included passing out missing person flyers and circulating photos from fake police reports of the fictional murders. People were convinced and convicted to the fact that it was real, and there were some real missing people, Hopkins said. They came from all over the place to try to do stuff to find people and help out. I asked Hopkins if there was any reason people should be afraid of camping behind Burkittsville. He said it was hunting season. There are bears in the region, and there is a limited cell phone service in the hills. Otherwise, no. After talking to Hopkins, Monica and I walked around the cemetery and looked at the fading gravestones dating back to the 1700s. There wasn't a cloud in the sky. Birds were chirping. It was a sunny, not spooky, 75-degree fall day. We left the graves to go talk to another local. And again, this takes place on October 20th. 2:08 p.m. On the outskirts of Burkittsville, Rob Miller welcomed us to his home, Apple Farm and Distillery, called Distillery Lane Cider Works. He had been renting the place out when Blair Witch came out. Miller and his family moved back onto the property a few years later and noticed the fanfare the movie brought. These kids would drive up from D.C. They'd see the sign and jump out, said Miller, whose farm backs up to the road where the Burkittsville sign is located. It was like they were doing something illegal, he said. They'd take their picture, then dive back into the car, whether they were worried about the witch coming out or it was just funny. Miller said he hadn't seen anyone stop by the sign in years, apparently missing Monica and me doing the exact same thing earlier. 3:51 p.m. We needed ice and firewood, so Monica and I drove to a nearby town. At the cash register at Rudy's Welding Service and Cold Beer, I asked the young cashier, this is sort of a weird question, but is there any reason you think this area is haunted? He and another employee mulled it over and then agreed, yeah, the area could be considered haunted. I would say definitely, the cashier said. A civil war went through here. This place is like 400 years old. The other guy said, some interesting things have happened there, which made sense with all of the Civil War history. They rattled off some of the reasons the area could be haunted, like the Blair Witch. 4:11 p.m., while searching for locals, I found Burkittsville resident Michael Robinson on Twitter and Instagram. He is a horror movie expert who has appeared on film podcasts. As Robinson greeted us at his house, his black cat, Freddy, as in Freddy Krueger, slunk by fiddlingly. Robinson moved to Burkittsville with his family 5 years ago. He moved for family, not the movie, but has since become the go-to source for all things Blair Witch. He has met many of the past crew and many of the cast and crew, and has been to filming locations such as Coffin Rock and Seneca Creek State Park. But while Robinson is a diehard horror movie fan, he doesn't think any of the storylines or ghost or supernatural beings in general exist off camera. I don't believe in anything like that, he said, including that the hills behind Burkittsville were haunted or that there would be anything scary about camping there. As if on cue, a gunshot fired off in the near distance. We all laughed, perhaps nervously, at the coincidence. 5:09 p.m. The sun was setting, and it was time for us to head to our campsite. Our conversations with the locals had tempered our expectations for ghost sightings. Even if I already didn't believe in ghosts, we still expected to be scared in the woods at night for more practical reasons, such as wild animals or escaped prisoners. Monica and I parked at the foot of the hill we would be hiking and packed up our gear, including some ghost hunting equipment such as electromagnetic field or EMF meters. These meters are used by ghost hunters to determine if alleged supernatural being is around, but they are normally used for measuring electromagnetic fields or just figuring out issues with electrical wiring. Our other tool was a digital thermometer. If there's a sudden drop in temperature, that supposedly means there is a paranormal activity happening. On the trek up from the parking lot onto the Appalachian Trail, we were losing daylight fast. To top things off, we ended up hiking to the coordinates of a campsite that didn't exist, an eerie nod to the Blair Witch character's own perils getting lost in the woods. Monica found an alternative campsite for us to try instead, so we trekked back to the car and drove 3 minutes down the road to a different parking lot to start over. 5:59 p.m. After tromping through yet another stretch of the Appalachian Trail, we finally found the backup campsite at Crampton's Gap, an area once controlled by Confederate soldiers, Miller had told me earlier. Despite the fact we were there to look for paranormal activity, the first part of our night looked like any other camping experience. We pitched our tents, struggled to make fire, and cooked dinner on the insanely heavy cast-iron skillet I insisted on packing. We ate steak and drank a couple of ciders Miller had given us at his farm. Then we plotted our 10 p.m. ghost hunt. Now 10 p.m. Our plan was to walk around the woods with the gear and leave the rest to fate. I put on my Blair Witch Project-inspired beanie and headlamp. Monica grabbed Pony, and we set out into the darkness. It may have been a full moon, but there was no evidence of that from our vantage point, shrouded under a thick canopy of leafy trees. We could only see things in the path of our headlamp spotlights. Monica was explaining their gear to me when Pony reared up and made a crying sound she hadn't made all day. "Oh, my God," I said to the dog. "What does that mean?" Monica was sure Pony just wanted to keep walking, not that the dog encountered a ghost spirit, so we continued our pursuit. The woods were bright with autumnal colors during the day, but now in the dark they were making me anxious. I didn't want to fall behind my pack. We hiked around holding the EMF meter up to the air, waiting for something to happen. Monica suggested we try talking to the ghost. "Hello, ghost," I started, having no clue how you're supposed to address spiritual beings. We summoned Civil War soldiers specifically, but nothing coaxed the spirits out as far as we could tell. Talking out loud to dead spirits in the night started to scare us. Even though I'm not a believer, I almost expected something to happen. 11:16 p.m., after an hour, we retreated back to camp. I had concluded that no news was good news, not for the story's sake, but if we had discovered the existence of ghosts on the hike, there would have been a lot of screaming and sprinting. Instead, we crawled into our separate tents, exhausted, and called it a night. I had been too distracted by the day's many activities to be really thinking about the Blair Witch Project, but alone in my tent trying to sleep, I couldn't stop picturing the most upsetting scenes of the movie. I tried to take my mind off them, envisioning happy things. The tactic worked long enough to fall asleep, and then she awakens again. She can't remember the time, but she said I had no idea what time it was, but my eyes snapped open in the middle of the night. I had heard noises crackling in the dark and regretted having my tent fully covered. There was no way of peeking out to check the surroundings. Instead of investigating further, I closed my eyes and fell back asleep again. And then around 4 o'clock, a crackling and rustling coming from different angles awakened me. I was sure it was danger. My heart started pounding, like they do in cartoons, and I wondered if the source of the sounds could be beating. I stayed motionless, trying to come up with a game plan. Would I come out of the tent screaming? Should I stay perfectly still until whatever was out there got close enough to attack? I don't know, and I just kept trying not to breathe too loud. Well, the story goes on to say that everything came out well, and they concluded it's not haunted. Just a lot of nature's noises. So there you go, my friends. A little dark tourism for you here on Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed this episode and that you'll join us again next week. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, reminding you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Questions and comments can be directed to 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.